Hello and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. I'm your host, Sally Rooney, the editor of the Stinging Fly, and joining me today is Jessica Trainer. Jessica's poetry has been published and translated widely, and her debut collection, Liffey Swim, published 2014, was shortlisted for the Strong Shine Award. Her new collection, The Quick, is published by Daedalus Press. She is also the Deputy Museum Director at EPIC, Ireland's Emigration Museum. On this podcast, if you're not already familiar with the idea, we ask writers to choose a piece from the Stinging Fly's archives to read and discuss. Jessica, can you tell me a little bit about the piece that you've chosen?
So I've chosen a piece by Wendy Erskine called To All Their Dues, a little extract from that. And it's a story that really intrigued me for a number of reasons. You really, really don't get a sense of where you're going to end up at the beginning of the story. But I think Wendy manages that in a very masterful fashion. What I really love about it is there's this kind of tripartite structure where the themes raised in each one kind of seamlessly blend into the next, and yet it never becomes predictable. And yet at the end, you feel this kind of sense of a culmination of meaning, which is really, really satisfying.
I'm so looking forward to discussing this piece with you after the reading, but we'll begin with a reading from the final section of the story, which I think is entitled Grace.
The worst was the street preaching, when they stood in Corn Market on a Saturday afternoon with two speakers, a microphone and a cardboard box full of tracts. If it rained, they put the box in a black bin bag. On the rare occasion they went to places like Portadown or Lurgan, and Grace didn't mind this so much because there would be no chance of seeing anyone from school. It would be the usual. You'd be cold and you'd get people either shouting abuse or laughing at you. But at least no one would know who you were. There were things you could do to pass the time. You could count the paving stones for as far as they stretched into the distance. They started square and then, as they got further and further away, became wafers. You could hold your breath until you saw someone with a pink coat. Then you could hold your breath until you saw someone with a green coat. Then you could hold your breath until you saw someone in brown boots. You could do those same things in Corn Market, but you had no anonymity. 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, there would be all the shrieking, laughing crowds from school. Is that not your wee woman from our year? Your wee doll in that big coat? It is her. Feel wick for her. Shout something over, but. Sometimes there would be competition from other groups. Fire eaters, choirs, and, now and again, break dancers who would bring a CD player and turn it up loud until the sound broke. Grace's dad would turn up the preacher's volume and his sound won out because it had an amp. It was a cosmic battle between good and evil right there in Corn Market, transmogrified into a street sermon versus too unlimited. An American evangelist had held an old-time crusade in a huge white tent on the O'Neill Road, and the very first night he went, Grace's dad had some kind of epiphany. On the next evening, Grace's mum had one too. They started going to a mission hall that was opposite an old dairy and constructed out of corrugated iron. Women had to wear hats. There were some people who had apparently been very bad, like Jimmy Baker, who had given his testimony and told everyone about how he had found the Lord after being a gambler and a womanizer and a communist street fighter. Jimmy Baker seemed so nice, sucking his mints in the back row. Sunday clothes were uncomfortable in ways you could not have imagined. The tights were always too small and the good wool skirt scratched. The label on the nape of the jacket was stiff, but it was stitched right in so you couldn't cut it out. The hat was like a pancake. There were lots of ways you could wear a beret, Grace's mother had said. Yeah, and every one of them stupid. The shop windows showed bright clothes, tight clothes. You walked past people, women, and they were all like the drawings in the maths books with the compass, soft, concurrent semicircles. Grace's clothes, bought at charity shops, were chosen for their amorphous quality. Her mother talked about good materials, wools, gabardine, camel hair, durable and decent. The girls in her class used tampons. Grace's mother thought tampons tantamount to rape. The preacher was called the Reverend Dr. Emery. Everything he said was in groups of three: sin, despair and iniquity, our saviour, past, present and future, a strong, hot, welcome cup of tea available at the back of the church after the service, the long, boring, repetitive service. You could stare at the Reverend Dr. Emery in the pulpit until he doubled and became surrounded in black light, and then you could look at the ceiling and see his outline in relief against the whitewashed beams. You could make bargains with the Lord. I will believe if you make your woman there's hat fall off. She scratches her neck. Split second when you think it might happen. Hat stays on. You could listen to tales from a mostly Old Testament world of hard justice. You could listen to his lamenting tone. Oh, why is the world filled with such evil? You could think, I don't know if I believe this. Then the Carson family started coming. They were tall, thin people, a husband and wife who'd been in Malawi for many years, mostly working on Bible translation, but involved in other projects too. Their own children had long left home, but they fostered kids short term, and they had plenty of room in their big double-fronted house with the overgrown garden. First, there was a boy, about 10, who had a hearing aid and a green coat. Grace wondered if he could hear what the Reverend Dr. Emery said. He mouthed the hymns like he was dubbed. Then there was an older boy, although he wasn't there for that long, whose head was always cocked to one side. Oh, aye, right, it said. Then there was a girl who overlapped with him for a month or so, fat with a pale face. Grace's mother had said, why don't you go over and talk to her after church? So Grace had tried, but the girl hadn't asked her anything back. Grace shifted from foot to foot until it was time to go. And then there was the next one who had a clump of hair dyed pink. After one of the Bible readings, she shouted out, Amen, and started laughing. There was an embarrassed, irritated shushing. Later, Grace's mum said, I think that girl's a bit lacking, shouting out like that. People don't shout out like that in our church. She did it with an American accent, said Grace. She's a bit lacking. But that didn't stop Grace's mother asking her to go round and help the girl, Kerry, with her schoolwork. Why? Said Grace. It didn't go well speaking to the other one. This is a different girl. She needs help with her schoolwork. Well, why can't Mrs. Carson help her? She's busy. You're going round tonight. I said to them that you would. Like I'm the genius. Don't be cheeky, Grace, her mother had said. Mrs. Carson said the bedroom was the first door on the right at the top of the stairs. Should she knock? Grace wasn't sure. Hello, she called. What you want? The girl said from inside. And then she came to the door. What you want? I meant to help you with stuff, said Grace. And that's what they said for me to come and do. Who? Them. What stuff? School stuff. I don't go to school, she said. Then why did they send me? I go to a centre, the girl said. They said I was to help you. Well, I don't want any help, said the girl, and closed the door. But her mother sent her back again the next night. Sometimes it's necessary to persevere. We need to do what we can, where we can. Not you again, the girl Kerry said, opening her door when Grace knocked. Behind her, everything was round the bed like a magnet. Clothes, magazines, dirty tights with the knickers still in them, cans of Coke. You could smell body spray, but mainly smoke. Did the Carsons not notice? Did you not get the message last time? She said. Why are you here again? Mrs. Carson called them downstairs. Kerry screwed up her face. On the dining room table, there was a book with a rabbit on the front cover and a worksheet. The other kids were playing out in the garden, even though it was raining a bit. Mrs. Carson said, Kerry, I want you to remember the talk we had earlier. You remember? No effort made with work, no allowance. No allowance, no whatever it is you like to buy. Kerry scowled across the table at Grace. Then she lifted the book about the rabbit and opened it at a random page. Her finger slowly ran under each word and her lips silently formed the words. She read about 10 pages like this, with Grace looking on redundant. Then she sighed, closed the book. Done, she said. What's it about? Asked Grace. Fucking rabbit, said Kerry. Did you not see the front of it? Is that what you have to read? If it wasn't, you think I'd be looking at it, huh? It's a rabbit that goes around doing stuff, she added. She dropped the book on the floor. The other one was about a homeless man, she said. Was it better? Grace asked. No, said Kerry. Come on up the stairs, she said. I want to show you something. Grace thought that Mrs. Carson might object, but she was involved in doing something in the kitchen and so said nothing. Grace found herself sitting on Kerry's rumpled bed. Kerry was pulling something out from behind her wardrobe. She sat down on the bed beside Grace with a magazine. Never mind that. Look at this, she said. She opened the magazine at a page where there was a woman lying on a sofa with her legs wide open. Not totally naked. She had on gold platform heels. What do you think of that then? Said Kerry, holding it up close to Grace's face. Grace said nothing. What do you think of that? She turned to another page with two women. And that? Never mind you coming round here to tell me about this or that or yon. You don't know it all. Look again at it. Look at it. Look at this one. They're all at it. All that lot in that tin box, just the same as everyone else. Same as everyone else. You're not normal, Kerry went on. You're really weird. I seen you sitting there with those two, your mum and dad, all holy, holy, and I think God help you. You know Helen Watson, who used to live here? Well, she said the same thing about you. Said you were a psycho. You're the one who's not normal, said Grace. Oh, why, is that right? I'm not going round like a granny mush fucking mouse. What you frightened of? Burning in hell? No, said Grace. I'm not going to burn in hell. Here, let me tell you something, said Kerry. Let me tell you something. What year were you born in? What year was it? 1980, said Grace. 1980. So in 1979, you weren't here. Were you bothered? You weren't. So when you're not here again because you're dead, will you be bothered? No. You weren't before, so you won't be again. Grace thought about this. Ha, said Kerry. Think about that one, she said. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Oh, but no, you can't because Jesus says don't smoke. 1979. It was a nothing. Kerry started reading the description of the woman from the magazine. Here, listen, she said. Listen to this. She read it with a big pause between each word, the cadence of a kid following the line with her finger. Cindy likes... What? Said Grace. What is it Cindy likes? Kerry puzzled at the word. Maybe, said Grace. Maybe you should stick to the rabbit book, Kerry. Kerry rolled up the mag and threw it at Grace. Read it yourself, she said. Grace grabbed it, twisted it tight and hit Kerry across the cheek with it. I didn't want to come here. Do you understand that? Kerry came charging across the room, grabbed Grace by the hair and threw her onto the bed, elbowed her hard in the gut. Grace gasped. She couldn't breathe out. But it was easier to hit Kerry than she would have thought. Her fist made contact with her stomach, taut as a drum, and she hit her again and again. They fell onto the floor on top of the dirty tights and the dirty plates. Kerry was quick and heavy, the ways she flipped Grace over, twisting her arm up behind her back. She couldn't move and Kerry kept pushing harder so that she thought she was going to be sick. And then Kerry stopped. She was panting, trying to catch her breath. All Grace could smell was the fags and the hot fabric conditioner. Mrs. Carson must put loads in the washes. Kerry took another handful of her hair and Grace thought she was going to get hit again, but instead, Kerry's mouth was soft, although you could taste the blood like a coin. At home, Grace's mother was sewing a hem. All go well? She asked. It was all right, Grace said. There are some booklets you could take round if Mrs. Carson gives you a call. There's those new ones that were sent from the States. Sure, said Grace. Her mother's hand stretched the thread taut, did a final double stitch and cut the thread. When they were next in church, there was a big empty space at the end of the pew where the Carsons sat. Kerry wasn't there. It was the same the week after and the week after that. After church, Mrs. Carson said that she was grateful that Grace had helped Kerry along a bit, but that she had gone back to live with her mother now. They come and they go, Mrs. Carson said. This is for you, she said. She gave Grace a folded up piece of paper with an address and a phone number on it. The frill of a spiral bound page torn off. Big bubble writing, written with careful deliberation, nearly pressed through the page. She kept the paper, even though she knew that she was never going to phone or call round. She couldn't imagine it. Going to the pictures with Kerry, going for a meal with Kerry, sending each other a valentine. It seemed preposterous. The next week, Grace didn't go to church. She said it was because she wasn't well, but when her mother came up to her room, she said, "The thing is, I'm giving going to church a miss for the time being." She knew that they prayed for her all the time. They sent Reverend Dr. Emery round to see her, and she sipped a cup of tea slowly while he told her about lost sheep and the prodigal son. He tried to scare her by talking about girls he had heard of who had strayed from the righteous path and who, without exception, had come to a bad end. They would congregate at the front door. There would be a whispering, and then he would go. There would invariably be a quiet knock on the door. "Everything all right, Grace?" Her mother would be hopeful. "Fine," Grace would nod. There was pain, and there was passion, and there was no God. Some people had to wait a lifetime to find out that kind of thing, had to study and read books, gaze up at the stars. But it had been made apparent to her when she was young. It had come all in a rush when someone was whacking her with a porno mag. You might never experience that intensity of revelation ever, ever again.
Well, thank you very much for that. Wonderful reading. So my first question is basically always the same. And we have discussed it a little bit in the introduction. I'm curious as to why you chose, obviously, this particular piece. And then even more specifically, why this was the excerpt from the story that you wanted to focus on.
Well, I mean, I suppose for the first part of the question, I chose this piece because it's one that I think undermines expectations to a certain degree, you know, and I'll talk a little bit more about how the first section and the last section relate in a minute. But it's a story that's full of kind of personal symbolisms. It's full of subtlety and nuance. There's a realism to it, and yet there's a huge imaginative scope. And I think there's, you know, from looking back, especially at the Stinging Fly stories, there are a number of different modes, but I think really what's very well expressed as the surrealist mode and the realist mode, the kind of naturalistic mode. And I think this story lives within that to some extent, but it really does manage to pack a huge amount in. I think there's an entire world chosen in this story. And I found it very kind of emotionally affecting. I found it funny. I found it nuanced. It just really grabbed me. And this particular section, I have to say, I'm cheating slightly because I have heard Wendy read this piece. And again, when I first heard her read it, which was actually in a reading in San Francisco quite recently, it was the first time I'd come across the piece, and I just did not know where we were going. And I was so gripped by this particular protagonist and the lightness of touch with which her entire experience is evoked. And just the way that Wendy deals with that kind of those personally formative sexual experiences, you know, they're incredibly difficult and challenging to deal with in fiction. But I think she does so in a way here that's full of kind of yearning and poignancy.
And so then to circle back to the idea of Grace as just one part of this sort of tripartite story. So the story is told in three parts. So we've heard a part of the final section, and the other two are named after two other characters, Mo and Kyle. So to me, all three of those sections almost felt like full short stories in their own right. And yet placing them all together as one story makes them mean something very different. So were you interested in the way that the context changed how we felt about what was happening?
For me, that's the most important aspect of this story. And it's very interesting because I read a couple of reviews that have called this a trouble story. And I think it's not a trouble story at all. I mean, they've been absolutely positive reviews. But I think that there's a kind of an issue with kind of criminality and different social interactions that telescopes down, kind of zooms down into this very, very personal experience. And so we kind of get the macrocosm first, and we really bed down into the microcosm of this woman's kind of personal formative experience. And in a way, what it does is it kind of shows how social contexts are formed by, on some level, these deeply personal interactions. But to call it a trouble story, I think, strips away a lot of the layers of what's going on. Absolutely, it's embedded in contemporary Northern Ireland. But I think to call it a trouble story is just to look at one aspect, maybe the aspect that we visit more, particularly in the first and second sections. That's certainly a part of it, but not the whole.
Absolutely. And one thing that I love about Wendy Erskine's work, and which I think you bring out so beautifully in that reading, is her extraordinary ear for dialogue, which has also been remarked on by critics. In your poetry too, you incorporate multiple voices, though maybe less straightforwardly. What do you think draws you to work that incorporates multiple different perspectives?
Well, I just think that that's really what fiction is. You know, it's the inhabiting of other perspectives. It's that kind of empathetic exercise, that empathetic leap, which I find this story in particular is full of. You know, and I think every story in the world is a mixture of kind of one part memory to eight parts imagination, you know, so there's that wonderful interplay between reality and then the notion of us kind of challenging ourselves to maybe experience something a little bit different. And one of the things I think that informs my own work and that I like about this work is it's actually, I think it's quite theatrical as a piece. And I would have spent a long time working in theatre, and I always found that the short story form was far more akin to the play form than perhaps the novel is. And it's to do very much with structure. And I think this is a really structured piece that manages to interweave all of this dialogue, this personal experience, but in a kind of a beautifully hermetically sealed way that the story wears very lightly. And I think that really what's shared between all of those three different elements, you know, the theatre, this story, and my own work, is that sense of really reliability of voices and narration, and placing those within this kind of bigger structure and seeing how it all plays out then.
The idea that a play somehow resembles a short story more than a novel is one I find very striking and certainly has never occurred to me before. Can you tell me a little bit more about where you think that resemblance comes from?
Well, I think it's a lot about, I mean, what I'm really interested in about this story, and I suppose I'm talking about one of the sections we don't read, but it's the kind of symbol of the snooker ball. I'm really interested by the way that in both a short story and a piece of theatre, the main action the main physical action usually takes place before or after the story begins. And what the story or the play does is positions the reader or the viewer on a journey that's kind of deals with the emotional lead up to something or the emotional fallout for something. The action in both the short story and the play and the interaction is generally not people, you know, running around committing violent acts. It is the kind of the deconstruction of what goes on emotionally and between people in order for these acts to take place. So this is a story that starts with a snooker ball being found on the floor. You know, the threat is not something that ever actually is expressed. It comes in the form of Kyle, who then comes to check up on his handiwork. And if it had started with if the window breaking had been a part of it, you know, a part of the actual present tense action of the story, it might not have worked, you know. Similarly, on stage, a lot of kind of violent interaction and stage fights can be one of the most tricky things to pull off.
Absolutely.
You know, because they become unreal. They ask for the audience to invest too much in the notion of these people up on a stage. Similarly with short stories, I think it really is about kind of creating that sense of tension or exploring the release of tension after an event. And I think Wendy kind of pitches this story really well in terms of the giant chronology of any story or novel that sprawls off on either side of the actual piece of action and interaction that you've chosen. I think Wendy's pitched this incredibly well.
I completely agree. And another thing that strikes me about the resemblance between what theatre is trying to do and what this story accomplishes is that sense of being watched, the sense, I mean, which I think comes across particularly strongly in the excerpt that you've chosen, and the sense that Grace feels, obviously at the very beginning of that excerpt when she is literally being watched in public, but also of Kerry's gaze on her and how transformative that becomes in the later scene that we heard, that's so deeply a part of our experience of reading the story. And of course, the feeling of being watched comes into the other excerpts, the other sections of the story, in a very different and more menacing way.
No, it's very interesting, and even I think the kind of the confrontation, the violence of the confrontation with the porno mag image, is fascinating. You know, that's one of these really interesting moments where, you know, Kerry challenges Grace, and Grace rises to the challenge to a certain extent. But you see how there is an abuse in that relationship, even though I find something very poignant in this relationship that never was. But there is a kind of a violence there and a confrontation that you see played out in Grace's relationship with Kyle as well. You know, you see somehow how perhaps, and you know, again, this is pop psychologizing to some extent, but perhaps the fact that this particular relationship could only take place in a very confrontational way has informed Grace's notion of how relationships play out, how people relate to each other. You know, and I don't want to give away too much about the story's end because I hope people go out and buy the book and read it. But you know, in a sense, what we get is Grace revisiting the site of minor pain, you know, this kind of minor pain in order to somehow feel the potential of that burgeoning relationship again, to revisit it in some way. But all of these things are aspects of people relating to each other in ways that are slightly damaged, and who are any of us to judge? But, you know, I think it's a story in which, yes, people observe other people, but also their reactions or their interactions are kind of slightly perpendicular to each other.
On the subject of Irish literary traditions, you have recently written, anger and politics are still perhaps not seen as fitting subject matter for poetry. I know you probably hate having yourself quoted back to yourself, because I hate it as well, but I think it's a really interesting point. And Wendy Erskine's work, I think, can certainly be read as political and has been, as you point out, read, you know, in a very specific political framework. But both in that violent confrontational vein that we see some of here, and in a more playful, subversive way also, there is definitely a strong political aspect to this collection of stories. Do you think that fiction then generally has more room to confront political realities than poetry, or there has more license maybe?
I think it absolutely does, which is a fantastic thing. You know, I think it's wonderful. And I think, you know, I think there's such a fantastic generation of short story writers in Ireland at the moment who are dealing with things in a really exciting way. You know, it feels like the tradition is being exploded at the moment, in novel writing, but also in short story writing. I think that with poetry, there's still a sense that everything is autobiographical. I think people still can't quite divorce themselves from the notion that the poet is always talking about themselves. And so that maybe makes some of the statements feel a little bit thinly veiled in a way, you know, that this is the poetic eye talking to the reader. Whereas in story, in fiction, I think you have a more elegant and eloquent vehicle in which to carry your message, you know, and one that people don't necessarily always assume is a kind of a kind of autobiography. So I think that maybe has made the difference, but I do think that's changing. I do still think in poetry there's a sense for people to ask women whether they have the right to be angry over political events, whereas, you know, nobody ever asked Heaney or Carson or Derek Mann.
Quite rightly.
And you know, and I'm glad they didn't, you know, but there's still a slight, I suppose, disconnect there, I feel.
And so do you think that disconnect is happening at the level of critical culture, so that it's not necessarily ingrained in the form of poetry versus the form of the short story, but in our kind of cultural responses to those forms?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I would definitely see it as, and it's kind of vestigial, and I think it's wearing off, but it is still, I think, a little bit more difficult to get past those questions of who has the right to certain responses in the poetry world.
Erskine reveals in this excerpt that we've just read, and also develops Grace's character using narrative, so principally through the story, the sort of anecdote of what happens in Kerry's room, but also a narrative at the end that we didn't quite get to, where there's another little scene which we won't reveal. As a poet, are you also concerned with that idea of revealing and developing character, or does poetry just use a totally different set of ideas and tools altogether?
No, I think they're actually very similar. And again, you know, I talked a second ago about story being a vehicle for message. And again, I think anecdote and symbol in poetry, I suppose, which is almost kind of to the extent of narrative, but not quite as strongly developed, unless you're talking about kind of overtly narrative poetry. But those are the things that should carry your meaning. You know, so you use symbol, you use anecdote, you know, you create scenarios in a poem that you hope will then act, as I said, as a vehicle for your intended statement. Otherwise, it's simply a news report, you know, or an editorial.
I guess that brings me back to the idea that poetry is often read in a sort of narrowly, reductively autobiographical way, when in fact, a poet may be just as interested as a novelist or a short story writer in creating a character, which isn't necessarily one that can be conflated with the poet's actual self, whatever that is.
Yeah. And I think, again, short story writers and poets share a certain amount of the same challenge when it comes to creating a character in that sense, or a voice or a persona that's fully formed, and, you know, kind of creating a mise-en-scène that puts the reader in the place where this person is fully formed enough and developed enough for the reader to buy in immediately to the experience. Now, of course, that's the challenge of all writers, and nobody wants to leave all of their kind of story scaffolding on the page. But I do think that it can be particularly challenging for short story writers and for poets. And I think it is something that Wendy Erskine does really well here. And the way that the three characters kind of flow from one to the next, it's, you know, again, this is, a few people have said to me that this is a very clever story, and I would agree with that, but I think it wears its cleverness wonderfully lightly, because I know sometimes clever can be used as a slightly barbed comment, you know, but I think it's the kind of story that you get lost in the moment of, and it's only later when you're reflecting on it that you realise how skillfully all of the connections have been set up, you know, and these three characters become interlinked in ways that are, you know, kind of narratively credible, but also thematically credible.
You're right. I mean, it is an incredibly clever story, but at the same time, it's very easy to read, which is a product of its cleverness. I mean, it seems so much technical craft has gone into making it as easy to read as it is, when at a sort of philosophical level, it's actually very complex, I think. So I don't think that this story, or that Wendy Erskine's work more generally, offers any easy answers to the very difficult questions that it raises, whether those be technical questions or philosophical questions. What do you think were some of the big questions that you were left with when this story concludes?
I think, you know, in a way, I know I said earlier that it's not a troubled story. I could contradict myself now.
Excellent.
But, you know, I think it is about ways in which, you know, society in general, and in this particular case, society in Northern Ireland, how violence can filter into people's interactions in really, really surprising ways, you know, so that somehow we have this broken window incident, which can be, is traceable back to this woman's girlhood sexual experience. And it's not saying that it's not a causal relationship necessarily, but it is kind of culminative, if I can pronounce the word, in a way, in that, you know, you have a society where, and a place and a time where two young girls can only express their sexuality in this particular instance and scenario in a certain way. And that in some way kind of impacts on the relationships of all of these various different people. So I think it's just really a kind of a deconstruction of how little violences can become embedded in our lives and in our relationships with other people in ways that are incredibly difficult to unpick. And I think Wendy unpicks it beautifully for us. So yes, I think the troubles is probably a wider context of that, and, you know, the kind of the payment of protection money and things like that. But I do think that this is a story that could happen anywhere.
I think that's very true. And the little violences that you mention are so embedded at the level of gender, sexuality, as well as in the very specific political framework. Mm. So the final question that I want to ask is, how does fiction, whether it be this particular story or fiction more generally, short stories and novels, inform your work as a poet, which obviously is formally very different?
To a huge extent, I think, you know, and I find reading other people's work always incredibly inspiring, because I think that really when I read other people's work, my subconscious starts to tick away and say, well, how would you approach this subject matter? And what does it remind you of in your own life? And is there an incident in your own life that in somehow compares? And how did that play out? So I feel like as a poet, there's a huge amount of lateral thinking in your creative process, whereby if I were to write something in response to this, you'd probably never know, you know. I always compare it to those kind of crosswords, you know, where the clues, you really have to use your left brain, or is it your right brain? Anyway, the lateral thinking process in order to kind of work the clues together. So I think, you know, in order, just in terms of being inspired by somebody else's kind of imaginative flight, and looking at the various different questions that are asked in a thematic level, and thinking again about your own response to these really universal questions. Yes, I find reading fiction very inspiring.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for joining us today. You've been a great guest and I've really enjoyed our discussion. If you have enjoyed the excerpt as much as we did, Wendy Erskine's debut story collection, Sweet Home, was published this year, 2018, by the Stinging Fly Press. I'd like to thank, as always, our producer, Ian Malini, and we will presumably see you again sometime in the future. Thanks for listening.